From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Fundamentalist leaders are strengthening their grip on Muslim communities in America, says Asra Nomani, a single Muslim mother determined not only to take back her mosque in Morgantown, West Virginia, but to create a movement that lifts Muslim women to pray next to men, to lead in Islamic prayer as equals in the Islamic world. Tonight on Point, one brave woman's campaign to change how Islam is practiced in America and the world. But first, we begin tonight with the latest on Kyrgyzstan, where 5,000 protesters today stormed the presidential compound in the capital city of Bishkek. Within hours, the country's president, Askar Akayev, had fled the palace and reportedly the country. In an emergency session, the parliament installed opposition leaders as acting president and prime minister and gave them until Friday to form a new government for the Central Asian country. Fred Weir is Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. I asked him to describe the sequence of today's events and their culmination in Kyrgyzstan.
It seems that over the past couple of days, several thousand opposition activists who are based mainly in the south of Kyrgyzstan infiltrated the capital, and they joined there with a few supporters and rallied, then stormed the government buildings. And the really amazing thing was that the security forces melted away. The president went into hiding and then left the country, and he's now resigned. It's astonishing because it really didn't seem that the Akayev regime was that weak. But you can never tell or predict these things in the former Soviet Union. This was an attempt by opposition forces who had lost an election quite decisively, but it was probably an irregular election and badly flawed one. This was an attempt to imitate what happened in Ukraine and before in Georgia, and it worked astoundingly well for them.
Fred, we read that President Askar Akayev has first left the presidential compound by helicopter for a nearby Russian air base and then later left the air base, current whereabouts unannounced. What were the forces in play here? Who or what forces did Akayev represent, and what about the opposition from the south?
Akayev has run Kyrgyzstan for the past 15 years, and he is one of that generation of post-Soviet leaders who actually were considered to be reformers, liberals, pro-Western types a few years ago. But it seems they created regimes that were, though not totally authoritarian, were not fully democratic either. They failed to keep the promises they made in the 1990s, that is, the post-Soviet promises, and also indulged in corruption and nepotism and whatnot. Among this, of course, Edward Shevardnadze, if you know, you remember, he was the head of Georgia, and he was a much-loved reformer and one of the architects of perestroika in the Gorbachev times. And Leonid Kuchma in Ukraine, pro-Western president, sent troops to Iraq to help the United States.
These all members of this generation that took over post-Soviet and then eventually came to their downfall. Let me ask you, in Kyrgyzstan's case, in the stands, generally there's been a lot of news about suppression of Islam or Islamic fundamentalism. Is there an Islamic factor here in Kyrgyzstan?
Well, yes. It's not the worst case there in Central Asia, but there's definitely there in the south where the opposition is strong, there is also an Islamic challenge. And indeed, all through that area where the tradition is Islamic.
Is it clear whether the opposition's victory today indicates some ascent of Islamic forces, or is it unrelated?
Nothing like that is clear. We only know that because there are so many poor, unemployed young men, landless and unemployed young men in there, and especially in the south of Kyrgyzstan, militant Islam fundamentalism is a present temptation for them. And we know that there are movements there in southern Kyrgyzstan particularly, which might well leap in to take advantage of the unrest and instability.
Fred, I know you're on your way to Kyrgyzstan soon. I wonder if we can look at the international ramifications here. You can't get much more remote or landlocked than Kyrgyzstan. I mean, when your neighbors are Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, China's outback, what does it matter to the former Soviet Union, to Central Asia, to the broader region, what's happened today in Kyrgyzstan?
Well, you have an American military base there, and just a few kilometers away, a Russian military base. This is one of the products of the post-9/11 war on terrorism. It's very strategic, especially in terms of the war on terrorism. And probably the most serious thing is what happened in Kyrgyzstan today has set an example for all of those neighbors you mentioned. They're all vulnerable to a similar type of upheaval. And this is what will have people biting their nails in Moscow and Washington and Beijing and further afield tonight.
These Central Asian countries have been generally quite friendly to Washington and its war on terror objectives and operations. Is there the risk to Washington's current plans that they could lose these bases?
Possible, but you see, we know so little about the opposition, about the people who have kind of blundered into power there today, that it's impossible to say right now with any precision what kind of policies they will be pursuing. But we do know that they've unhinged the region a little bit, and there will be consequences, and no one knows what they will be down the road.
Fred, good travels to Kyrgyzstan. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Fred Weir is a correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke with me from Moscow. To see photos of today's turmoil in Kyrgyzstan, go to onpointradio.org. Azra Nomani was born in India and raised Muslim in Morgantown, West Virginia. She became a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. She wrote and traveled the world. Just months after 9/11, she was in Karachi, Pakistan, when her friend and fellow reporter Daniel Pearl was kidnapped and killed. Then the Muslim father of her child balked at marriage, and Asra Nomani balked at Islam as practiced in the world today. She's become an Islamic rebel with a cause to restore women's rights within Islam, to restore Islam to its gentler self, and to awake moderate American Muslims to the rise of Islamic fundamentalism inside the USA. Tonight on Point, Asra Nomani's campaign to change Islam as it is practiced in America and the world. You can join the conversation tonight. Can you imagine being an unwed Muslim mother taking on much of the Islamic world in the name of Muslim women? Can you feel the courage it takes as a woman to walk through the men-only main entrance of a contemporary Islamic mosque and demand that Islam, as practiced, be changed? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Asra Nomani. She is author of the new book, Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. She's written a Bill of Rights for Muslim women. This past Friday, she organized a women-led multi-gender Muslim prayer service in New York. 24 police were on guard as protesters shouted outside. And yesterday at Brandeis University in Waltham, Massachusetts, Nomani led a second multi-gender prayer service. Her campaign has sparked debate within Muslim communities in the United States and internationally. Egypt's chief interpreter of Islamic law has condemned her actions. She joins me now in the studio. Good evening and welcome, Asra Nomani.
Thanks for having me here.
Gosh, you're on a tear.
I'm committed to taking the slam out of Islam.
Very contemporary way of doing
it.
Yes, I like it. My gosh, just a ball of fire, and it just goes on. I'm looking at a wire story straight off the wires here. You are condemned today by Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, and he warns that the co-ed women-led Muslim prayer service in New York last week, if this kind of thing goes on, he said, this disrespect will create millions of bin Ladens. And he told this to nothing less than the Arab League in Algeria. You're right in the center of the Islamic world's agenda. What are you doing there?
I'm trying to challenge the power structure that is allowing this strain of intolerant Islam to be practiced in the world. I'm basically trying to take head-on all that which is perpetuated in the name of Islam but betrays the real principles of our faith. I'm trying to stand up as a woman within the faith so that the world will know that what we're seeing in terms of destruction and anger and intolerance is not Islam.
How far out of the mainstream are you?
I'm not far out from the mainstream. I'm only unique in that I'm standing up and speaking strongly, but that's because of the experiences in my life that give me passion and tell me that we have to change and challenge. But I believe that my point of view represents so many Muslims. Sadly, like them, I was silent for so long. When I went to Karachi, Pakistan, I had a dramatic wake-up call. And it brings me here today.
We'll talk about that after the break coming up. But you say you began life, like so many moderate Muslims, relatively disengaged, kind of disengaged spectator. When you looked into the mosque, what did you find?
Oh, it was terrible. I remember a few years ago when I went with my father and I sat alone in the women's section with faux wood paneling as my only companion.
This in Morgantown, West Virginia.
Yeah. My father had fought to at least allow women to have an entrance. So that we had. But I was alone, and the men were in the other room, beautiful carpet and clean space. I was amidst filing cabinets spilling with papers, tipping over in any moment. And all I could hear were the laughter and the crackling of their sounds over this loudspeaker. And I felt so alone. And I never returned to that little dinky space of a mosque that we had then.
Asra Nomani is not willing to sit in the back of the Muslim bus, and she's talking about it. Her new book is Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. You can join our conversation tonight. Can you imagine being a single, unwed mother going into the heart of Wahhabi Saudi Arabia on pilgrimage to Mecca? We'll hear about that. Can you imagine being a single, unwed mother taking on all Islam in the name of Muslim women, in the name of a different view of Islam? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We'll be right back with Asra Nomani. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with one brave Muslim woman who wants to change Islam as practiced in America and the world today. Asra Nomani is with us. You heard her say just now she wants to take the slam out of Islam. Her new book is Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. You can join the conversation tonight. Can you feel the courage it takes to walk into the men-only main hall of a contemporary Islamic mosque, and we'll hear how she's done it, and demand that all Islam change? Muslim women, are you on board with Asra Nomani? Do you support her call for change? Non-Muslim women, can you imagine what it's like to walk in the shoes of a Muslim woman today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Asra Nomani, we want to get to your big themes, but we can't understand them properly without understanding your story. Take us quickly through the basics here. It gets very dramatic in recent years. But you were born in India. Your parents came to the United States to study.
Right.
You followed them shortly there. You were born Muslim in India, of course, Hindu India, but a large Muslim minority there.
Right.
You grew up in Morgantown. Take it away, the points that will help us understand where you are now.
I grew up learning to square dance at 10 with a boy named David Stitzel. I never went to the Drummond Chapel church dances because my parents had raised me as a good Muslim girl.
But they let you square dance?
Only because I begged my mom to sign the permission slip. Mm-hmm.
That was the beginning of the end right there.
That's when I first crossed the hudud, the sacred boundaries that are put around a Muslim girl.
I'm kind of jesting, but it's no joke, the hudud.
It's not. And I was going to learn that in a very deep way later in my life. But they believed in me. They believed that I could be anybody that I wanted to be. They encouraged me in every way possible. They were religious and they were conservative, but they were progressive and they were forward-thinking. So I ran track. I wore shorts. I went to science camp in Tahlequah, Oklahoma.
Away from home, as a girl, as a Muslim girl, did you know that this was pressing the boundary, that this was pressing the lines of hudud?
I wept.
Wept to get it, or wept because you felt guilty, or wept why?
I wept because I knew that I was departing from a tradition that I had inherited. A girl didn't leave the home until she was married for her husband's home. And I knew that the separation meant that I was leaving something very safe and that the rest that would come before me was unpredictable. Mm. And so on my 16th birthday, I got on this airplane in Pittsburgh, and I wept both from fear and with anticipation of what the new days would bring to me.
Your road took you into a career with the Wall Street Journal as a journalist, lots of postings there. And fast forwarding a decade, lots of experience in the hurly-burly of the journalism world, no shielded community there.
Right.
And you are out kind of on a search for yourself in a way. You wrote a book, started out to be about tantric sex, ended up as kind of a memoir of searching for your own identity. 9/11 comes, and in the months after, you're in Karachi, Pakistan, a good friend of Daniel Pearl, of course, the Wall Street Journal reporter who was kidnapped, who was videoed being killed by Islamic extremists, a shaking experience for you. He had stayed with you, I think, the night before he was kidnapped.
His wife, Marianne, and Danny, they had both come to my house. Danny had a big interview, very much sparked out of Boston. He had read the Boston Globe story tracing Richard Reed's handler to...
Richard Reed, the shoe bomber accosted on the airplane.
He had read the article tracing Richard Reed to a handler in Pakistan. He believed that man was a man by the name of Sheikh Jilani. And he arrived at my house on January 22nd, excited about an interview the next day that he thought was with Sheikh Jilani. In fact, it ended up just being this web in which he was kidnapped.
A devastating experience for everybody who knew Daniel Pearl and many others. You were witnessing it firsthand. This was a great friend. At the same time, you were in the midst of your own kind of personal trauma. You were soon with child, expecting to marry a Pakistani Muslim man, the father of that child. That didn't happen. Why?
My boyfriend walked away from me out of fear.
First,
he was afraid of the Pakistani intelligence agencies that were now swooping on my house.
Because you'd been associated with Daniel Pearl and all of that.
Right. And it's a legitimate fear in that part of the world. But then, when I learned that I was pregnant, he was afraid of crossing those sacred boundaries. Because, literally, in Pakistan, we have hudud laws that punish a woman like myself in that circumstance with 100 lashes. And
that is pregnant out of wedlock.
Exactly.
So you were transgressive in an important way.
Yeah. In creating life, I was also a criminal. And this was a heavy burden that weighed on me even more because I was a criminal in the eyes of Islamic law, in the eyes of my religion. And I had to also absorb the fact that a group of men had prayed 5 times a day to Mecca and then killed my friend in the name of Islam. So it was a terrible time.
And from that time and the birth of your son in November of that year, 2002, I mean, looking back on this history, it reads as though you just went on a tear.
I really thought that I was going to go back to West Virginia and raise my son with my parents nearby, living a quiet life, writing novels. I didn't want to deal with the reality of this world anymore. But something remained strong within me, and that was justice and the fact that we had to bring justice to this world, that it wasn't right that people could kill innocents in the name of religion and my religion, that I could be ashamed of my son because of my religion. So when my son came into this world, I realized that I had an incredible responsibility to raise him with happiness and to raise him in a world that was safer than the one in which he had just entered. And I chose happiness, and I knew, though, that I had to find some space within my religion. And I had to reconcile this terrible clash that I had.
Then a series of big events, and maybe first of all, the global became local. A new mosque with your father as one of its founders opened in Morgantown, West Virginia, and I guess it's fair to say you made gender a very large issue at the front door of that mosque. Tell us the story.
Well, when my son was born, He brought new life to me. And the pilgrimage to Mecca represents newborn life. So I went with him in his first 3 months, and I went with my family, my parents, and my niece and my nephew. It was intergenerational, and it was beautiful.
Your pilgrimage came before the Morgantown Mosque incident. That's right. So first the Hajj,
right?
An enormous event in itself.
It's huge. It's a spiritual mosh pit, basically. You go in there, and you are shoulder to shoulder with humanity.
We've seen the photographs, just an endless sea around the Dome of the Rock. You went as a woman.
Around the House of Kaaba.
The House of Kaaba, yeah. Excuse me. Of course, excuse
right.
me. Yes. You went as a woman and a single mother.
Yeah.
How was it what you expected?
That's why the title of the book is Standing Alone in Mecca, because I felt like I was standing alone, that I had gone into Wahhabi Islam, you know, the brand of Islam that the Saudi Arabian government endorses and puts out into the world, where a woman is a criminal when she is, as I was, and am, an unwed mother. And I went afraid. I went afraid that we would get arrested, because my mother and I do not wear hijab normally in our lives. The head covering, and strands of hair would fall out, and I was afraid that the religious police would swoop upon us. But there in Mecca, in that sea of humanity, people were so kind. That mosh pit has men and women tumbling into each other. There is no segregation. There is no back door.
There, of all places.
The holiest place in the Muslim world is free of barriers between men and women. We run in the footsteps of a woman named Hajar that the world knows as Hagar.
You're going very far back now.
But yet, in the contemporary day, millions of pilgrims run in the footsteps of this woman left alone in Mecca by Abraham. And yet, I realized...
This is the mother of Ishmael. Kind of the line of the Islamic world goes back to her.
Yeah, but all we know of each other is as the sons and daughters of Abraham,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
But the tribe into which the Prophet Muhammad was born in the 7th century goes back to this great woman. And there I finally felt the pulse of the strength of women in our community, and I felt fully realized as a woman. So then, with this knowledge, I come back home to Morgantown, excited, ready to raise my son in the Islam that I experienced.
On fire with that experience.
Yeah, I really felt my faith restored again in Islam. The people were so kind. They patted my son Shibli on the head. They were loving to all of us.
Shibli, this is a name we run into again and again with our Arab guests. Means lion cub.
Yes, it means my lion cub.
My lion cub, no less. Well, that's a name given by a loving mother.
And being a good American kid, his favorite DVD is, of course, My Lion King.
One day.
Yes.
But you came back, and far from Wahhabi Saudi Arabia, and ran into some pretty stiff opposition to your new enthusiasm. How did it play out at the doors of the mosque in Morgantown, the new mosque where your father was a founder?
So I told you a moment ago about that dinky little space, mm-hmm. right? I never went back again. But now they had opened a $500,000 mosque. Chandeliers, bright lights, you could see them from the street outside. I thought that it represented the new opportunity of Islam in my life. And I walked up as a mother, my son on my hip, the same hijab that I wore in Mecca, same flowing white fabric going all the way down my back. And an elder from Egypt stood there at the door and screamed, "Sister, take the back door." And I was horrified, because in Mecca, men from Indonesia, Turkey, Nigeria said, "Assalamu alaikum, peace be upon you." And I would eagerly greet them back, "Wa alaikum assalam." And I didn't even get a greeting of
Not
decency.
Not even good morning, just back of the bus, back door.
Take your space.
Mm-hmm.
Shut up and take your space.
Mm-hmm.
I was horrified, and I realized at that moment that we had a gap between the way Islam is meant to be practiced and the way it is practiced in this world.
You eventually walk through that front door in defiance of the mosque elders, and you've gone right on with that walking. Last Friday, in Morningside Heights in Manhattan, you organized a prayer service led by a woman with men and women praying side by side. It sounds, in terms of many religions, quite a modest undertaking, but in the world of your religion, Islam, earth-shaking. We've got the top Islamic theologian in Egypt condemning this, and as we read earlier, we've got Muammar Gaddafi at the Arab League in Algiers condemning it today, saying that this disrespect to Islam will create millions of bin Ladens. What are you doing?
I'm convinced that Osama bin Laden himself is looking for a sat phone somewhere to send his fatwa denouncing our action, because what we're doing is striking a blow to the corruption in our Muslim world, striking a blow to the men who use man-made rules to maintain their power and control. And we are doing this for the world, for Islam, and for peace. Basically, the power structure allows extremism to control the masses. What I've now figured out is that we have this well-oiled machinery, this corporation almost. As a Wall Street Journal reporter, I always think about following the money. And to me, it's come to the sad reality that we're up against a Wahhabi Incorporated. You know, it's Wahhabi Inc. that we're facing. They have on their payroll all of these sheikhs and mullahs who want to maintain power and control, and we're challenging them, and they don't like it, and nobody who has their power and control challenged wants to simply give it up. They don't just say, oh yeah, you're right, women, of course you had that right, we just didn't tell you about it.
We're going to come right down to the differences in interpretation of the Quran and Islamic teaching, how you see it, but I want to begin to bring our callers in. They've been waiting patiently here. We're talking tonight with Asra Nomani. She's author of the new book, Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Saeed is calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Saeed, you're on the air.
Well, thank you very much for taking my call, and thank you, Asra, for what you are doing. By no means are you alone. It is interesting to me that the true Islam, the faith that I grew up with in a tolerant Islam, is now being championed by the people like Shirin Abadi or Mehrangiz Akar, Irshad Manji, and yourself, all women, that dare to stand and speak the truth about the faith of Islam. I grew up in a tolerant pre-revolutionary Iran. The Islam that I grew up with has no resemblance to what is being practiced in the name of Islam today.
Saeed, do you think that the view that Asra is putting forth here tonight that you seem to share, can it prevail, or is it up against too much entrenched opposition?
No, I am certain that it can prevail. The Islam that I grew up with was concerned more about more of ijtihad than it was of jihad.
Meaning?
Ijtihad meaning the personal interpretation of faith.
Mm-hmm.
What is being done now in the name of Islam in for example in Iran precludes the individual from any interpretation or assessment. In fact, a recently university professor in Iran was sentenced to death, and then for the simple statement that we must not follow blindly what the Ayatollahs say, that it is incumbent upon each of us to interpret ijtihad.
Saeed, we hear you resonating, and we're grateful for your call. Thank you very much for calling in tonight. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Asra, here's a vote of support from the heartland. You've had a lot of opposition as well. What do you hear in this You Go Girl call?
I love it, and I appreciate Saeed's call. And what Saeed reminds me is this important point that, you know, this battle is not divided by gender. We have amazing brothers who are standing beside us. One of my fellow supporters is a man who said that he would babysit the children during our Friday service, because this is the job that women are usually relegated to do. And these men represent the real face of Islam, not Osama bin Laden.
And do you share his confidence that your ijtihad, your personal interpretation, your campaign can win. The cliffs look so high.
Absolutely. We defeated slavery in this country, and the church was used to protect it. We defeated segregation, and the church was used. What we're facing with the Wahhabis and the other fundamentalists is the same enterprise and empire of extremism that has always tried to exclude most of the population. And progress is inevitable.
Azra Nomani, stand by. The new book is Standing Alone in Mecca. You can join our conversation tonight. Do you buy that the true heart of Islam is open and compassionate, as Azra Nomani suggests? Can the slam be taken out of Islam? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Azra Nomani, one brave Muslim woman. She is out to change Islam as practiced in America and the world today. She's out with a new book as well, Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Azra Nomani, I wish you'd take us right to the heart of this issue of women in Islam. You write in your book that the Prophet, Muhammad, was indeed, in your words, the Muslim world's first feminist. I have to say, that's not how it looks as a lay person looking on. Make your case that the Prophet was a feminist, that Islam is at its heart welcoming of women, open even to equality of women. Let's hear it.
Well, yesterday I went and I led prayer at Brandeis because I was sponsored by the Center for Investigative Journalism. And I didn't even understand for myself what has brought me to this place of understanding, but it's investigation. It's the spirit of journalism that I'd been doing for 15 years, covering really boring topics for the Wall Street Journal. What has happened in Islam is not much unlike the story of the Da Vinci Code, where women's history has been erased. In the 6th century, it was called the period of Jahiliyyah, ignorance. And when the Prophet Muhammad brought Islam to the world in the 7th century, he brought inheritance rights for women, the right to divorce. His first wife was a woman 15 years older than him who proposed marriage to him, and she was his boss. He didn't turn her away and say, "You're too strong for me." Mm. He accepted her strength. His daughter Fatima was strong and powerful, choosing her own husband. A later wife, Aisha, rode on camelback in battle. He designated one of the world's first Florence Nightingales to set up an operation in a mosque in Medina. He had women as leaders and theologians, and I can never find an instance where a woman came to him and said, "I want to move forward," and he said no. Each instance is forward progress. Women were never witnesses, and then they became witnesses. They had rights that they had never had before. What went wrong? Mm. In the first centuries of Islam, the segregationist ideas of other civilizations entered into the Islamic society.
Other civilizations like?
The Near Eastern societies, Abyssinian society, and the veil became obligatory. Segregation became a part of Muslim society. And slowly but surely, women lost that initial role that they had had in the first century of Islam when the Prophet was alive.
I don't know the texts well enough. Are you sort of reduced to looking at parables and interpreting actions? Do the texts support your view or the view of the gender segregationists, the sacred texts in Islam?
The Quran refers equally to men and women. The Quran talks about men and women's roles in completely equal terms as as responsible for the well-being of our society.
Top to bottom, front to back. I mean, you know how the Bible is, generally a very tolerant message, but you can find very tough stuff in there. In the Quran, can Islamic scholars not find justification for the segregation of women?
It's just like the Bible was used to justify slavery and segregation of blacks and whites. It can all be interpreted and misinterpreted and I believe ultimately betrayed, because all of those principles reflect bigotry and sexism, and that's not what Islam was about. It was about social justice.
So now you're posting, kind of like Martin Luther, you're posting instead of the 95 Theses, you've got, I think, 99 precepts, and you've got an Islamic Bill of Rights. And not just that, but two, an Islamic Bill of Rights for women in the mosque, an Islamic Bill of Rights for women in the bedroom. 20 points in all, very explicit, both about what ought to be permitted in the mosque and permitted, allowed, respected in the bedroom. Mm-hmm. Why is this necessary? I guess the reality answers itself, but you put it in your words.
Well, women's bodies are used as prisons, and our sexuality is used to imprison us. When I went to my mosque in Morgantown and prayed 20 feet behind the men, they surrounded me and swooped upon me, and they yelled at me and said that I was creating fitna, which is a very, very strong word for conflict. It's something associated with the apocalypse. And they said that I was too much of a temptation and that women were too much of a temptation. They said that a woman's voice was not to be heard in the mosque because it would be too arousing to the men.
So here you are, the Bill of Rights for women in the mosque. Pretty straightforward stuff. Have the right to enter a mosque, number one. Have the right to enter through the main door. Have an Islamic right to visual and auditory access to the main sanctuary. These seem like
no-brainers.
Things, no-brainers, right. But they are not.
They're huge. Can I tell you, two out of three mosques in good old America require women to sit behind a partition. Sometimes it's a dingy basement. Sometimes it's a trailer separate from the rest of the mosque. Sometimes you're staring at a TV screen looking at the preacher. But in all those cases, they're barriers to entry.
And then a Bill of Rights for women in the bedroom. Again, very simple things. Women have an Islamic right to respectful and pleasurable sexual experience. I can imagine the fitna that will set off. Women have an Islamic right to say no to sex. Women have an Islamic right to make independent decisions about the choice of a partner. Straightforward, but really rocking the boat.
They are. I mean, basically, I was stunned. A man last night in my hometown of Morgantown, a year ago, yelled and screamed at my father and me because I dared to sit behind the men during a study session. A year later, beautifully, he acknowledges he was wrong, but he protests the Bill of Rights in the bedroom that says that a woman has a right to say no to her husband. This is a man who's a professor in America who still carries these traditional ideas that a woman's body is his to control. That's unacceptable.
I've been keeping so many callers at bay, and I apologize. Let's turn to them. Shabnam is calling from Belmont, Massachusetts. Shabnam, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm so glad you're having this program. But, I really don't understand what Ms. Nomani is trying to do, because the way she's talking, it's as if women are. She's kind of trying to exploit the American experience of segregation and making it sound like women are segregated from men, and so that's necessarily a bad thing. But the thing in Islam is that there is no priesthood, and there is no sacrament, and there is no sanctuary. She talked about a sanctuary. There's no sanctuary. There's just rooms. Islam is totally democratic. There's no ordained or hereditary priesthood. There are no wafers or holy water.
Why can't women walk through the main door? Why can't they share the same sanctuary?
May I just finish with
please,
that?
Please, yeah.
There is no sanctuary, so please don't say that there is one.
Because there's a mosque. There's a main hall.
No, there's a mosque, but there is no sanctuary. Because I've been to both Jewish and Christian places of worship. There's always an altar. In the synagogue, there's an altar.
Shabnam, it sounds like you're splitting hairs. You don't see any difference in status of women and men in the Islamic community today?
because in the mosque there is no women are in a separate room or in a room in the same room separated by a curtain or whatever. They're not mystic. There's no performance.
Our time is short. Let us pick it up. Azra Nomani, are you making a lot of distinctions that have no real difference, no significance here? Shabnam saying, what's the big deal? You're misinterpreting. You know, you don't even have a priest at an Islamic prayer service.
Well, I respect the right of all women to make whatever choices that they wish because we are not all the same. But the bottom line is we do have an imam who stands in the front, whom we follow and whose sermons we listen to. Having grown up in the classroom, I don't want to sit in a separate room. I don't want to watch the teacher on a video screen or listen through curtains. That's my choice, and I respect that choice of so many women who want to stay behind the curtain, but there is a generation of us that don't want that.
You have said that fundamentalist Islam is growing in America. There's not enough attention being paid to it, and moderate Muslims are not standing up to it. What's going on?
I listen to sermons from the pulpit because I could sit in that main hall and look into the eyes of the preacher that spewed what I thought was completely unacceptable rhetoric.
In your hometown mosque in Morgantown?
Yeah, saying that we need to hate those who hate the Prophet Muhammad, that we unchaste women are worthless, that a working woman is unacceptable, that it is unacceptable for us to befriend Jews and Christians. I've seen the slippery slope of where that leads, and I won't stand by. But sadly, I would ask a man from Indonesia, what do you think about what was just said? And he would say, oh, I was sleeping. I would ask someone else, and he said, oh, we don't listen to what they're saying. It would go in one ear and out the other. I know that that kind of rhetoric has staying power and that we have to erase it in all forms, in all religions, in all societies. My place is in Islam, so I stand up within this faith, but I ask all moderates and all societies to stand up against that kind of hate speech.
Who's winning that race in the U.S. and in the world right now, the moderates or fundamentalists?
I think the fundamentalists are very much defining how Islam is seen in this world and how it's expressed. I think the moderates are finally starting to stand up and realize that the stakes for their own personal lives is very high because civil liberties are being denied Muslims because of the actions of these extremist minorities.
Is this a project of centuries? Can you turn this around in your lifetime?
My son is 2 years old and just a few months, and I shout out to him because he's listening out there somewhere.
Hi, Shibley.
And I'm dedicated that within the next 2 decades, by the time he reaches adulthood, we will have a new reality. Women in America were able to transform their experience in corporate America in 2 decades. We can do the same, I believe, in this world.
One brave Muslim woman and ambitious, Azra Nomani, author of Standing Alone in Mecca, An American Woman's Struggle for the Soul of Islam. Thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you for having me here.
This is On Point. They have taken the sports world by storm with their hustle and grit and consecutive upsets of national college basketball powerhouses. The University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Panthers are the lowest-ranked team remaining in the NCAA Men's Basketball Championship. But their intensely scrappy, never-say-die style of play is winning fans and striking fear across the country, especially in neighboring Illinois, home of the number one-ranked Illini. Nick Detman is a senior at UWM and the sports editor of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Post. Earlier, I caught up with him as he was driving to the team's big game tonight against Illinois in Chicago. I asked him if Panther fever had taken over the Milwaukee campus.
It's kind of hard to say right now because we're on spring break at this time, but I was in campus earlier today and there was a long line of people trying to get merchandise for the game, either for the game tonight or just something to hold on to this great memory that their basketball team is giving everybody right now.
It is exactly what the NCAA tournament is supposed to be all about, and your team is delivering it, just coming from such a low seed, number 12, and tearing up the court. Where does this intensity come from, Nick?
Well, if you've watched any of the two games, you could probably get a hint that it comes from the coach. He's just a very energetic coach. Bruce Pearl's done an unbelievably terrific job of that, too. I mean, there's not enough adjectives out there to describe what he has done for the programming. We wouldn't be here sitting here talking about the Panthers if it wasn't for Bruce Pearl, who came in about 4 years ago after Bo Ryan, who's now at Wisconsin.
He came out of Boston College, beat Boston College in this tournament, a big upset there. But still, the team out on the court, I mean, you've seen how they're described. CBS Sportsline says Milwaukee, UW-Milwaukee remains the carnival act of the Sweet 16, the bearded lady, the goat boy, the number 12 seed that won't go away. I mean, this is some tough stuff that's been laid on them, and still they come out just playing like crazy.
Yeah, it's like that little kid in those little sports that you always played growing up. It's just the one kid that just would not give up. I mean, that's what these guys, the way their mentality was going into the tournament a few weeks ago. They said, we have absolutely nothing to lose, and that's the way we're going to play. And I think we're very much seeing that they have absolutely nothing to lose. There's no pressure on these guys, and they're taking full advantage of everybody doubting them. It's like, if you want to keep doubting us, bring it on, because we're going to surprise a lot of people. And I can't think of anybody else that they haven't surprised yet.
You've got five transfers on the team, four of whom have junior college experience, and they are practically swinging from the rafters with that intensity. What kind of school is University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, Nick? It's a commuter school by and large. We read you've got one dormitory, so a lot of kids must be commuting here from around the city, around the region.
Yeah, I'm actually a commuter myself. I come into campus about 10 minutes outside every day. It's primarily a commuter school, but there's a lot of residences like condos or apartment complexes around the campus that a lot of the students like to take advantage of and reside in that area. And of course, we have the dorms, which only hold about maybe 3,000 students, and 25,000 plus go to the school. So there's a lot of people who come into the school every day. So not many people really follow the basketball team very frequently because they don't get a chance to get to the games.
And of course, five transfers on the squad. They can't be real well known to the school, but have you felt the campus rallying around this team as it made these incredible steps up the ladder?
Yeah, there's definitely a lot of people rallying around the program. You can see it all across when you walk across campus or walk across the student union. There's signs saying, good luck, Panthers, viewing party in the gas house, which is like a student restaurant. In our student union, they have like a new number of big screen televisions. And a lot of people are rallying around this team. A lot of people are finding out who these, like you mentioned before, the junior college players are. And, of course, everybody knows now who Ed McCants is, who's one of those junior college transfers.
Nick, big victories already for the Milwaukee Panthers, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Panthers. They've already won two big ones. Who knows what will happen in the game that's going on as we speak. But what should we take away from this story of the team coming up from this low seed and climbing so high?
I think now a lot of people, a lot more high schoolers or even junior college players are going to want to come to UW-Milwaukee. They see the quality of the program that is established at UWM. More people are going to want to come because they know they're going to be able to play for a championship each and every year. They're going to get a chance to play in an NCAA tournament game, even go on to the Sweet 16. Who knows, maybe Elite Eight or Final Four appearance sometime near the near future. So it's an exciting time now to be a UWM student, fan, and basketball player.
Well, it stung when they bested our Boston team, but we wish them well tonight. Nick Dittman, thanks very much for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me on.
Nick Dittman is sports editor for the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee Post and a senior at UWM. His Panthers are squaring off right now with the number one ranked team in the nation, Illinois, in the NCAA Sweet 16. The Illini lead 27-23. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.